You should have told me before. Anyways, hi
Do
everybody.
you want me to heckle you or something? Is
Yeah,
that
exactly.
the
I want you
idea?
to present for me, Kyle, is actually what I want. You can send me some Bravo points to work tomorrow or something like that.
Yes.
Okay, hi everybody, in person and online. I don't can the people online see me too? Oh, I see there's a camera at the back. Hello, people, or they can't. I just want to know how online I am. They just see my screen? Okay, cool. Ah, should have done my hair. Don't wander too much. Okay, got it. Good evening, everybody. Welcome. My name is Chris Imrie. I'm the unit operations specialist at the Waterloo Control Tower. I've met some of you before in person. Pleased to meet some of you personally. Thanks for having me here tonight. A little bit about me, and then we'll talk about the company. This presentation is a presentation that NAV wants us to give. So some of the stuff comes from them with some speaker's notes and some instructions. Some of you may have seen it before because it tends to be repeated material year over year. And then I'm the color commentary. So I get to give you guys the inside scoop today and what's going on at Waterloo Tower. As Gord mentioned, I've been at Waterloo for about a year and a half. I won a competition, which means I applied to be the unit supervisor and interviewed, and I won the competition and began training in January of 2024. It took me until October to earn my license. Air traffic controllers have an air traffic control license, which is very similar to a pilot's license, and it has an endorsement on each site that you work at, just like a pilot's license would have a night endorsement or it would have a float rating, those types of things. So I have an air traffic control license. It says that I'm a VFR tower controller, and I have an endorsement for Waterloo, and I have an endorsement for Sault Ste. Marie. Prior to coming to Waterloo, I worked in Sault Ste. Marie for 7 years as an operational controller. Joined the company in 2014, trained at Pearson Tower along with everybody else, where I was ultimately unsuccessful along with everybody else, and then went to London and trained in London as well. So I'm kind of fortunate that I've been with the company for about 12 years now, and I've worked at Pearson, London, Sault Ste. Marie, and now Waterloo. As mentioned before, yeah, my favorite. I actually did my private pilot's license training in Waterloo in 2009 at the Waterloo Wellington Flight Center. So I'm a private pilot, single engine land sea with a night endorsement, and I think I'm pushing about 500 or 600 hours, which isn't a lot, but when you're paying out of pocket for it adds up pretty quick in 12 years. Well, I guess it's would that be 10, maybe 15, 16 years now? 17 years. Okay, my math is good. So that's a little bit about me. I still fly. I have a 1951 Piper Super Cub on floats. It's the nicest Super Cub in Ontario. Ask me, I'll tell you. And it lives at Orillia. So when I want to fly, I drive to Orillia. We put the plane in the water, and I tend to fly back and forth into the Georgian Bay and a little bit north back to Sault Ste. Marie in the Sudbury area and what have you. When I was in the Sioux, I did a lot of fly and fishing into small, remote backcountry lakes. With some of my colleagues and friends up there, it was quite a good time. So I have a pretty diverse experience as a pilot and as an air traffic controller, and happy to share that experience and use that to inform some of my decisions at work and beyond. So today we're going to talk about NAV Canada. We're going to talk about the facilities that NAV Canada operates, the type of service that we provide, local operations. So those are the operations that you might be familiar with or might need some extra familiarity with at the Waterloo Control Tower. And then we'll talk about runway safety, communications, aviation occurrence reporting. Then finally, you'll all get my email address, which you can use to contact me and say how awesome the controllers were that you talked to on the weekend. They're the best ones because they're working weekends. A little bit about NAV Canada. So NAV Canada is in 1996, Transport Canada got out of the air navigation service business. They sold it to NAV Canada, which is a private, independent, not-for-profit organization. We're responsible for air traffic control, flight information service, weather briefings, aeronautical information, and other critical aviation services to aircrew. So we are the only private air navigation service provider in the world. It's a very unique setup. Most people think we're government, but we're not. NAV Canada is funded by user fees. So you guys all pay the NAV Canada fee for your airplane tails once a year. It's fairly reasonable. I think mine was like $125 last year or something like that. And that gets you unlimited on-demand service from any controller anytime. Mostly unlimited, which I'm sure I'll hear about in a little while. But I like to say to people or remind people that we have the best customer service in the business. You call us, we call you back right away. There's no wait on hold. There's no push one. We'll call you back in 10 minutes. We're there right for you. And if you have an emergency, we're there for you right away. And there's a bunch of things that you're getting access to for that nominal fee. Most of NAV Canada's billing is to the airlines. So when you book a flight to In Vancouver, for instance, you'll see a Nav Canada fee on your plane ticket, and that's because the airlines are charged per track mile for their flights across the country, and they redistribute that fee, or they pass that fee on to the customers who are flying. So you can actually, I feel like Blake's probably done this, but you can probably go online and dig into it, and you'll see like what the rates are that places charge, or what the charge rates are for the airlines flying, and the bulk of Nav Canada's revenue is generated, you know, that way. The board of directors is actually made up of the airlines, so WestJet has a seat, Air Canada has a seat, and then there's other seats, but those are the two big guys that are on there. There's a business aviation seat, there's employee representatives, but the board is obviously published, and that's how the whole operation works. We've got some facts and figures for you. So the ACC, so these are the IFR control centers, the Toronto ACCs, for example, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Vancouver, Moncton, and Gander, and Montreal, of course. They did 3.3 million flights last year. And for the towers, flight service stations, and remote aerodrome advisory service, we're talking about 6.2 million movements. So we're doing a lot of traffic. There's 18 million square kilometers, sorry, of airspace, which is managed by Nav Canada. And that plays into that revenue stream as well, because if you're flying from New York to Vancouver, you're flying over Canada, and those airlines are also billed for the air navigation services that they receive flying over here. As a not-for-profit corporation, we invest directly in our operations, our people, and our infrastructure. So Nav Canada doesn't make money. All the money we get in, we put back in. Radars are very expensive. Kyle will tell you. I think he knows. ADS-B, all this kind of technology is a big deal. And staffing continues to be, you know, going concern. Air traffic controllers, there's only about 2,000 of us in the country, and they are retiring faster than we're making them, which continues to be a problem everywhere in many industries, but especially in ours. There are different types of facilities that Nav Canada operates. So we have area control centers, which I just talked about. Those are the, I call them bunkers. That's where all the en route IFR controllers are working. For the Toronto FIR, it's at Pearson at Midfield Road. They're kind of right in the middle of the field, a block away from the control tower. Flight service stations, so those are providing aerodrome advisory services. In Ontario, we have Kingston, St. Catharines, Sudbury, North Bay, Timmins, Muskoka. Muskoka is remote operated by Timmins, and only in the summer. I feel like I'm forgetting someone, but those are the ones that I remember offhand. I should have made a list. Community aerodrome radio stations. I actually don't know where those are. Those are operated under contract, and I believe they're in more remote parts of Canada. Control towers like ours, and then technology work centers. Kyle, I keep bringing his name up because I'm, you know, embarrassed. And he works out of London. There's also tech ops out of Hamilton, and they're spread out geographically through the regions to service all the technology that we have at the control towers and the area control centers and so on and so forth. This is a map of the sites. You can see we've got the seven, I don't know how well it shows for you guys, but we've got the seven area control centers, the control towers, flight service stations, all of those are listed there, the technology work centers and so on and so forth. Actually, the community aerodrome stations are there, so if you can see one, looks like there's one in Resolute Bay, in case you're in the neighborhood, Gord, Resolute Bay, on the way to... No? Okay. Around the world. So those are where the sites are located and the services provided. I always think this is really interesting. You guys may have a better sense of this because you're pilots, but sometimes we have people come to the control tower who are community members or people who are learning about the business of air traffic control. And there's actually like a lot of people involved in what we do. So it starts with pre-flight. You know, in the old days, you used to call the London Flight Information Center and you'd get a weather briefing and you'd file your flight plan. Most people are doing that online now. Even though you're doing it through 4Flight, Nav Canada is capturing that data and filing it in our own system, which is used for search and rescue and also for IFR planning through the systems and what have you. So there's the whole pre-flight component. Then when we get to takeoff, you know, you're talking to a clearance delivery controller at some places, a ground controller or multiple ground controllers, a tower controller, and then once you depart IFR, you're talking to an en route controller low level, en route controller medium level airspace, high level airspace, and then switching laterally to controllers all the way across the country. I'm sure many of you have looked at like Flight Radar 24 and seen how many airplanes are flying in the sky at a time, and you know all of those airplanes, certainly the high level ones, are talking to an air navigation service provider, a controller somewhere. So this is that whole flight. And then again, on landing, you come back down through the system. So high root controller, mid-level controller, low-level controller, terminal controller, tower controller, ground controller, and then sometimes apron control, which isn't provided by us, but is there. So there's a lot of air traffic controllers that are involved in a safe flight across the country, commercial and for general aviation as well. You're dealing with ground control and tower control. Some of you probably take flight following services from Toronto Centre when you're en route. And so those people and those flight following services change depending on geographically where you're going. You'll be working through multiple controllers as you transit the country on a cross country. So there's different types of service that these different types of facilities provide. And I believe it goes through one by one, so I don't have to remember. So the first is, and this is again the facilities map. We're in the Toronto FIR. This is the second time we've seen this map. It looks really good. Oh, seven regions. Sorry about this. 5,000 employees. Okay, here's what I want to talk about. So flight service stations. So flight service stations provide airport advisory service. They provide flight information service. They provide a vehicle control service and an alerting service. So the flight information service is like, hey, St. Catharines Radio, I'm 10 to the east, inbound for a full stop. And they'll say, Roger, the winds are this. This runway is being used and traffic is this. They'll provide you with a traffic advisory. You'll say, Roger, I'm planning to join crossoverhead and join the mid-left downwind. And they'll say, Roger, again, and off you go. They'll also provide flight information about the weather at the field, obviously, or local weather, PIREPs, SIGMETs, any other weather events that are going on. And on the ground, they have positive control of vehicles at the airfield. So if you land at St. Catharines, the flight service specialist is responsible to make sure that there are no vehicles on the runway prior to you landing. They have positive control of vehicles. They don't have positive control of the airplanes. That's what controllers do, and so that's advisory. So when you land at St. Catharines, you'll report off the field, and after that happens, the flight service specialist would be able to put a vehicle out onto the runway for bird run or a runway inspection or other, you know, routine operations for the airport. Alerting service, if you're overdue on a flight plan, the flight service stations, just like the air traffic control towers and the flight information centers, play a role in that search and rescue dispatch and follow up moving from there. Control tower, Waterloo control tower is the one you're hopefully most familiar with. We provide an airport control service, so that's positive control for all of the airplanes in the control zone at Waterloo. It's from the surface to 4,000 ASL and a 5 nautical mile radius based on the center of the field. We also provide a flight information service. That's the wind and weather at the field. We do that through the ATIS primarily. If you go to a place that doesn't have an ATIS or a place that's less busy, the tower controllers will actually provide you with the updated wind information and altimeter with every time you're coming or leaving the control zone. But we do it via the ATIS to save on frequency congestion. And we also get alerting service. The phone will ring and someone will say, hey, is Uniform Bravo India back from their cross country? And we'll say, yeah, they landed a minute ago, and they say, okay, because that person landed but didn't yet have a chance to call the FIC and close their flight plan indicating that they had arrived. Area control centers at the Toronto ACC, they provide the area and terminal control service, flight information services, and alerting services en route. They're dealing mostly with IFR traffic, actually entirely with IFR traffic, but they do the flight information service for you when you're getting flight following, flying around in Southern Ontario. The flight information centers provide pilot briefing services, flight information services en route, so you can get your weather in the air as you're flying across the country, which I've had to do before. It's like, oh, there's a thunderstorm I wasn't expecting. Can someone tell me about it? They're quite helpful and very knowledgeable in that regard. And they also accept VFR flight plans and dispatch alerting services. Are they going to make me say this again? Oh, flight information service again, weather and aeronautical information, flight plan related tasks, and known traffic information. So that flight information service is provided, you know, by a number of facilities for situational awareness for pilots as they're flying in the area. We have a note here about capacity management. So one of the things that's interesting that NAV Canada does is that we are also involved in capacity management at all of the airports. And there's a website, I don't know, sorry, it's Stephen. Stephen, I don't know if you can, is there a web, can you pull a website up too? There's a website, it's public domain, it's at, let me know when you're ready and all. It's spaces.navcanada.ca. And if you go to the top left there, you'll see the little toggle there, great. So click that and we'll start with, I believe it's flight planning. And if you hit, oh no, I lied. Go back up to the left there, maybe try NC AeroView. Yeah, and Toronto FIR is the top, and you can hit YKF, CYKF. There you go, great. So this is an interesting, Spaces has a couple of things, and one of it is one of the things they want to point your attention to will be capacity management in a moment, but this is a really handy tool for pilots. It gives you the current wind and altimeter setting, and that's based on the readings at the field, and it also gives you the current ATIS message. So this information is broadcast in real time. The ATIS gives you the hourly weather observation, so that's quite common. You know, the hourly weather comes out and goes on the ATIS. But that wind information is actually the current wind information that's coming off of the AWOS. So you can see on the hour, they were saying the winds were 030 at 8 knots. That was a special at 2336 Zulu, but the current winds are 010 at 6 knots. So this information is available online. There was actually a drone operator that was doing some work for us, and they're like, we need to know the winds. And I was like, oh, you can check this, you know, at 3 a.m. before you come to the airport. And they were like, really? And that kind of changed their operation, you know, immensely, because it's giving you the real-time winds. Because if you're flying at night or when the tower is closed, the ATIS is not serviceable. You're just getting the AWOS information, which again would be broadcast here. Back to the capacity management spiel. If you go to the menu in the top left, please, again, Stephen, thank you. And then NCOIS. There you go. And this is an interesting thing. This is the capacity management that NAV Canada is running at all of the different airports or the majors in the Canada right now. So for Pearson, you can see the operation today is 06 left, 05 for arrivals and departing 05, 06 left. And AAR is the average arrival rate. That's 48 airplanes per hour. And the ADR is the average departure rate, and that's 40 airplanes an hour. And so that's the current metering system that's going on at Toronto Pearson. So on a bad thunderstorm day, you'll see that number go down to maybe 25 or 15, right, as they need more in-trail spacing or heavy IFR. Currently, the weather's pretty VFR, I'm guessing, which is why the average arrival rate and departure rates are so high. So there's 88 airplanes moving per hour, arriving or departing at Pearson right now. That's the target. And that's the kind of capacity management piece. So it has to do with how many airplanes are coming, what kind of spacing is required in order to be able to land everybody safely and meet the minimum safe spacing on arrival, but also the weather requirements. You know, the IFR minimums, if we're down to minimums on a Cat 1 or a Cat 2 approach, we need more space behind the airplanes in front of us than you do if everybody can see everybody and they can all see the runway and everything's hunky-dory. But it is kind of interesting to be able to access this information, because sometimes you'll be flying and they'll say, oh, there's air traffic control delays. And everyone's sitting in the airplane saying, what does that mean? And if you go to this website, you'll see exactly what that means. Currently, there's no flow programs in effect, but you can see down below ground delay and airspace flow programs. It'll tell you if there's a flow program in effect and the reason for that flow program. So they may be like, okay, there's a flow program for delays into Pearson due staffing or capacity management issues. We're managing that arrival rate down to 25. And in order to do that, you know, you can expect delays for your departures depending on where you're coming from. If you want to switch me back to, great, thanks. So capacity management, you know, is a really interesting thing that a lot of people don't really know about. At Waterloo, we manage capacity not quite that granularly because we don't have an arrival rate or an understanding of who's flying when. At all the VFR towers, we take the traffic as it comes. So you decide you want to go flying and we say, okay, come on in, or we say, remain clear of the zone while we deal with 15 of your other colleagues who are also trying to get into the airfield at the same time. And that's the capacity that we're dealing with. So let's talk a little bit about, so that's about NAV Canada and some of the things that we do. Does anybody have any questions about, or do we want to hold questions to the end? I don't know how this works with online, like what works best. Okay, we'll wait till the end for questions then. But if you have questions about NAV Canada, that's sort of that portion. Now we talk a little bit about our local operations here at the Waterloo Control Tower. So the Waterloo Control Tower is the eighth busiest, Waterloo Airport, sorry, is the eighth busiest airport in Canada. We're the second busiest control tower in the Toronto FIR outside of Toronto Pearson. Last year we did actually 148,000 movements, and it was a kind of an eight-year peak year for us in terms of traffic. 95% or more actually of our movements are VFR. It's mostly driven by the Flying Club. We have the largest fixed wing, we have one of the largest fixed wing FTUs in the country. That's the Waterloo Wellington Flying Club. They have 35 airplanes in their fleet, to the best of my knowledge. And we also have the largest helicopter school, and that's Great Lakes Helicopter. They just added about, I don't know if it was a dozen or 10 more helicopters to their fleet, so they're quite, they're huge. They have a lot of things going on. And also, we have all the private general aviation. I'm told that there's about 150 general aviation airplanes based at the field, and that's without including some of the business or corporate flying that we have. Air Sprint comes in and out quite frequently. There's the Chartwright hangars at the north end. We got Tri-City Aero, Rotorcraft, Flightline's busy. That's right. Yeah, no, don't forget Flightline, Apron 3. And so there's a lot of stuff that's going on at this airport, which can make it really quite congested and quite interesting for us in the control tower and for you as pilots at times. But it is interesting because most of our traffic is VFR. The IFR traffic represents less than 5%. Sometimes it's 2 or 3%, even with all the increase in Flair and Chartwright and all these other operators who are coming to the field. Bombardier is based at the field now. They do some flight testing there. It's still primarily VFR. So on the busy days, we're busy. Last year's peak day, so 2026 peak day, was about 865 movements. And tower's open for 16 hours a day. And so if someone's good at math, they can do that for me and tell me, but it's a lot of airplanes is what it is. Peak hour at Waterloo, I tend to see peaks roughly between 65 and 75 movements per hour, and a movement is one arrival or one departure. The caveat with that is that a touch-and-go counts as two, because it's one arrival and one departure is a touch-and-go. But again, if you're moving 65 airplanes an hour, you're talking about an airplane every minute, you know, either arriving or departing, which is quite substantive in our operation. Most of you have seen this from an airplane. So this is obviously a map of the control zone. It's really hard to illustrate this in Google Earth, but I did. I was able to put all of the waypoints, all the arrival waypoints and departure waypoints on there in orange, which I thought would make them stand out, but apparently not. So we can kind of pass on to this one here, and you can see this is inside the CFS. It's updated every 56 days, but it hasn't really changed since its last release, which I believe is about a year and a half ago now. And you can see all the waypoints there. What is interesting, I don't have this page available, but it does have the phonetics. All those waypoints have like a five-letter phonetic, and I'm told that you can put those into ForeFlight and it'll map them for you in ForeFlight. You can also use them when you're filing your VFR flight plan. So if you were planning to fly a VFR flight plan inbound, you know, that would give a direct point that you're going in. Doesn't really matter as much for us in the control tower because we're still just going to tell you to fly to wherever we want you to fly to, but it will help you with situational awareness if you have that technology to be able to use it and get to the right point at the right time. Funny story, I often tell people, fly to Puslinch Lake. Someone flew to Puslinch Lake the other day. I said, hey, go to Puslinch Lake. And he flew to the waypoint, Puslinch Lake, which is the correct thing to do. But I thought Puslinch Lake was over the lake. And it's not. It's north of the 401, just north of the lake. So he was not where I was expecting him to be, which was, of course, a problem. And most of the people in the control tower, you know, think Puslinch Lake is over Puslinch Lake because that would make sense. But it's not. It's north of the 401. So I may look at changing that if I can and making it actually over Justin Bieber's house or something like that because the lake is the lake. That's the easy thing to find. We don't use that one very often, but it's an easy geographic point to hold aircraft at just outside of the control zone. So it's kind of handy, particularly on a 32 operation or a 26 operation. You guys are all familiar with the airport layout. There's a couple of hot points that we like to kind of point out here before we talk about the runway safety program. So areas of particular interest for us are Alpha crossing runway 32. Probably once or twice a year, somebody accidentally will blow Alpha right across runway 32 when it's the active runway. So we want extra diligence there. There is some pretty good signage, but Alpha taxiway, depending on who you ask, may or may not exist. It might be about 20 feet at the line before the apron. So the airport's turned that whole apron into apron 3, which is uncontrolled, and Alpha taxiway is somewhat unclear based on the markings on the ramp. We've talked to them about it, but they need that all that space so they can push two 737s back. They need the extra lanes to be able to have the 37s push back off the gate. So they're kind of like happy with the way that it is. But technically, and please don't do this, you can taxi right up to Alpha and you're still on the apron and you could block that exit from the runway without talking to anybody. You'd be perfectly well within your operating rights on the apron because it's uncontrolled, but the controllers would be quite disappointed in your performance. So use a lot of diligence around Alpha taxiway as you're approaching it to cross in either direction. Or if you've been instructed to taxi Bravo for departure off 32, make sure you're making that right turn in a timely manner. The other hot spot that we see a lot of is Charlie Taxiway for the threshold of 08. It's very quick for you to be right onto the runway there at Charlie Taxiway as you're going across. So if you're usually we limit it to about two aircraft at Charlie short of 08, but again, I've seen aircraft go right through runway 08 to the other side because they're not paying attention or they follow someone else, you know, by accident. And we certainly want to limit people ending up on the runway by accident. The other big field constraint that you guys all experience is that Alpha Taxiway is one way. So it's one way going for departure off 26 and it's one way coming back. We can't run aircraft side by each on Alpha Taxiway. It's not wide enough and the airport won't permit it. There's some conversation at the Transport Canada level that all taxiways in Canada are meant to be one way single aircraft taxiways, even the big ones. So we'll see whether or not that comes out in the future. In Sault Ste. Marie, we used to pass them two ways on the taxiway all the time. In London, there's a couple taxiways that are very wide and you'll pass them two on the taxiway all the time. But there's some conversation that perhaps all taxiways are only meant to be holding one direction of traffic. And it's very difficult on the ground because you can't always see who's coming. So someone coming out of apron three or coming out of apron four at the south end there can't tell that there's someone on Alpha Taxiway taxiing, you know, across. And in an effort to expedite traffic, we'll sometimes say taxi apron your discretion to hold short Alpha. You'll be like, where am I supposed to hold short? There's no line. You're correct. There's no line. But the idea is to leave space for someone to get in front of you and pass through for you to go. And usually when we issue that instruction, it's by the time you get to Alpha Taxiway, that person's already kind of gone by or there's been enough time for you to be able to see that they've gone. When you see delays, stand by for taxi, it's often because the exits are full. What we try to do is kind of group the people going back and forth for departure off 26. So, you know, we'll put three airplanes in Foxtrot and maybe three airplanes in Echo and then move six airplanes down to the aprons at the same time. So we just got a nice flow going and then bring more people out as opposed to like one, 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 which is inefficient. I will say that it does happen to me, especially Echo and Fox taxiways are right below the tower. So if you're sitting in the tower, if you don't stand up, you can't really see you guys. So sometimes we forget you in Foxtrot. So like, you know, if you're sitting there and it's been a long time and you see a bunch of airplanes go by and you're kind of like, well, what's going on here? Don't be afraid to call and say, hey, I'm ready to go. Because we may have forgotten. But typically, you know, sometimes we may send someone out all the way from apron one before you call and you'll have to wait for that long, long, long taxi for someone to come out, which isn't really great, but it does happen. Some people like to use the whole runway, which is your right. It is 7,000 feet long and they'll try to land long and exit left on 14. Sounds really good for you, which it is. It's just really bad for like the 14 people waiting to depart. So, you know, as much as you can, if you think you need 14, it's best to ask us if you want to land long. Oftentimes people say, hey, can I land long for exit on 14? And we're like, well, it's not actually any faster because there's no ground traffic right now, so you're disrupting everybody else, you know, for your exit when you could exit at Echo with no impact to the operation. And that's our job is to manage that whole operation and be situationally aware of everything else that's going on. Trust me, we want you back home as fast as possible. Nobody wants to talk to you for longer than we have to. We want you to get out, get your safe flight, get back, and get back to the ramp safely. We're not interested in having you burn gas and sit around, you know, endlessly because we're tired or not paying attention. But it does happen. Again, we're the eighth busiest airport in the country and the second busiest in the FIR, and there's a lot going on there for us. So it's quite substantial. I don't think. If there's a chance to, I may talk. I think someone asked about staffing, so we may get that in the question period. I don't know if there's a staffing component in the presentation, but we'll talk about staffing too. So we have a runway safety program. Gord attends the Joint Runway Safety Team meetings. Those are every, I think, quarterly we have them now, and that's a chance for us to review some runway safety items, including incursions from the previous months, safety activities that are going on at the airfield upcoming and in the past. And it also gives an opportunity for everybody to get together and talk about runway safety and talk about their general aviation and flight training experiences at the field. The airport sends an operative there as well to attend. And things like signage are discussed, things like activity that's happened in the last little while are reviewed. It's pretty productive, I think, for the most part. And we try to keep it efficient. I try to keep it efficient. But it is something that you'll see more and more of. There was a finding at an ICAO audit of Transport Canada that there's a lack of joint runway safety committees at airports across the country. And Transport Canada has issued initially now an advisory circular, which just sort of suggests that airport operators have runway safety committee meetings. But they are thinking about legislating that or adding that as part of airport certification that you'll have to have a runway safety committee. So even non-certified airports may start having them. I don't know about other places other than mine, but they do exist, and Nav Canada has some supports available online. If you go to Nav's website and talk about runway safety committees, there's a whole page about with the terms of reference and ICAO references and some stuff to help get one going where you are. So we talk about incursion prevention. We like clear and professional phraseology. There is a phraseology guide. Phraseology is a funny word. We talk about it a lot in our line of work, but these are the words that we use and the way that we use them. We have a very robust program for what gets said in what order and how and what needs to be said. And so we are required to say things like, if the winds are 15 knots or greater, including gusts, we have to give them to you on a landing clearance. We have to say cleared with a particular instruction. We also have a requirement to issue runway wind altimeter in that order, so it can't be in another order. In Canada, you'll hear us say cleared for takeoff, runway 3-2. In the United States, they'll say other things after the runway. We're not allowed to say anything after the runway. So it's cleared for takeoff, runway 3-2. It's not cleared for takeoff, runway 3-2. You can plan a right turnout. Cleared for takeoff has to be the last thing in that transmission. So our phraseology is very strict and very rigid, and we have a phraseology guidebook that's available for general aviation pilots that will help you to use correct phraseology. but ours is very strict, and we've been laughing about it because the company is really trying to target that, make sure that our phraseology is professional at all times. And we're dealing with a lot of newer professional pilots who are a little bit loose with their phraseology, and so it's funny that there's no standard on the pilot side, but we're held to like a very strict standard on our side. And it happened today where somebody tried to tell us how they preferred to receive a clearance. We issued an IFR clearance to somebody. We're like, no, you're cleared to the blah 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 airport via the blah 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 blah, you know, flight plan route, depart runway 3-2, squawk 1-2-3-4. And he came back and he said, next time, can you just not give us any of the spellings, and can you not do this, and can you not do that? And we were like, I mean, no, we can't. That's not how the deal is. The deal is that we have to say it this way. Part of my job is doing the quality assurance at the tower. So I listen to 100 transmissions from each controller at regular intervals, and I rate them against the book phraseology to make sure that they're compliant and they're meeting that. And that's a component of our quality assurance program and our certification. So our phraseology standards are very high and very clearly communicated to all the controllers, and we train very highly to it. But again, we're dealing with a variety of experienced pilots with varying phraseology, which continues to be a challenge. But the phraseology handbook's a good resource and a good toolkit for people who are scared or nervous or unfamiliar with talking at a control tower. And I gave someone a hard time the other day. There was a student came in from Brantford. It was busy, and they couldn't work the radio. And I was like, guys, you can't. This isn't a good day for this. Like, you know, we're really busy, and the student didn't know where they were. They didn't know, you know, how to talk to ATC. They didn't know how to work the radios. And the instructor is like just letting them, you know, fail, which is part of instruction. I understand that. But at the busiest airport in the region at that time of day, it was just like, this isn't really helpful. I have to say everything 2 and 3 times, and that delays our ability to provide service to everyone else. So knowing what you're going to say and saying it in a clear, concise manner really smooths the whole operation for everybody. The last story I have on that is I was training in London, and it was really busy. Everybody was coming back in. We get the same thing at Waterloo, where it's really, really very busy, and people are trying to get their transmissions in. It's very difficult for them to do it. And I remember I was just fighting the airplanes, just trying to keep above water, and some guy checks in. He's like, Waterloo Tower, it's Alpha Bravo Charlie 6 North, 2500 a mile, full stop. I was like, cleared right down one. Easiest transmission I ever had to make, right? Because he already teed up. He said all the right things in the right order at the right time. I knew exactly where he was. I knew exactly what he wanted to do, and I could let him in unrestricted, you know? And so it really makes a huge difference for our efficiency of the operation when you're able to check in with the information clearly and concisely and meet the controller where it's at. Sometimes you can't do that. You know, you're 20 to the west, you're squawking 1200, and you call us up and you say, hey, it's Alpha Bravo Charlie 20 to the west, 2500 feet inbound, full stop. And we're like, who? What? And part of that's not having the squawk code, you know, already tagged up. And part of that's, you know, we're busy with something else and we're not recognizing you that far out. But certainly hearing what we're saying and getting those transmissions done as quickly and efficiently as possible makes a big difference. Runway excursions. We talk about runway excursions at the Joint Runway Safety Committee. We've had a couple this year. We actually had one last week into the snowbank off to the side. We had an aircraft earlier this week veer off the runway into the infield, and we had a gear collapse this year as well as a ground loop earlier this year. So in my 1 year, 1.5 years of the tower, I've seen a handful of these incidents. Thankfully, no one got injured. The airplanes were injured. I'm sure some egos were injured, but all the people were okay. But it does happen, and it's really important to recognize the wind conditions and your airplane performance limitations. We have guidelines in our manual of operations that says if the winds are within these limits, we use this runway. If the winds are within these limits, we use this runway. But it is up to the pilots to make that determination. If you're unable to accept a crosswind on a particular day or onto a particular runway, you're certainly welcome to ask for a different one. And if you require it because the winds exceed the limitations for that particular operation, you know, we'll do our best to make it happen. You just may end up with a somewhat of a delay while we tee that up if you need to land on a different runway or go opposite the normal flow of traffic. But the guys are pretty good. The team's really good. They'll try to make it happen for you if you really need it. You just have to be able to work with us in terms of orbiting or giving us some extra time to clear the runway and make sure it's safe for you. Excursions, same deal. I mean, we had the famous flare excursion. The Transportation Safety Board reports out about that. I believe that happened outside of tower hours. There's no other excursions that I'm aware of except for the infield ones that I just mentioned. But again, there's some information in the Joint Runway Safety Committee meetings on that, as well as online safety reports and so on and so forth. I think I talked a little bit about communication, and I talked about the phraseology books, so you can access those at your leisure. They are available online, and they're pretty good. The AIM, I don't think, covers phraseology. I haven't read it on the toilet in a long time, but I'm going to do that based on Pat's recommendations. So available for, was it $16.95 at Hammond Aviation? $17.95 Hammond Aviation. That's my plug. They sponsored me. So there's a VFR a phraseology book, and IFR phraseology book is great for people who want to practice on it. A couple of best practices: listen before speaking on the frequency, but it does get very congested, so it's hard. I know you're listening and other people are stepping on you, but typically you'll hear that transaction that the controller is having with a pilot. So, you know, it's like Yankee Echo Echo Tower, inbound from the north, cleared right down, and you'll hear that back and forth. And once that transaction is over, feel free to jump in after you hear a second or two of silence. It does get very busy here. When I was training in January of 2024, I remember I got really busy, and I was like, just stop for a minute to take a breath. And I was like, and that was it. And I was four calls behind. So it was just so busy. You were just like, oh my goodness, people just kept calling. I took literally that long of a breath, and there were four or five calls that piled up in that short period of time. So be patient. Think and plan what you're going to say before you say it. So, you know, we love talking to you guys. When it's quiet, when it's busy, we don't want to talk to you as much. But, you know what you're saying before you hit that mic. So make sure you know where you are, know your altitude. If you're squawking a code, you can let us know, or be prepared to receive a squawk code. That's the first thing we're going to do, is to try to tag you up. And then what your intentions are, full stop, circuit, or transit the control zone. Also, be familiar with I don't know if that comes up afterwards, so I won't go there yet. Small pause after pushing the push to talk to button, and again before releasing it. Everyone's push to talks work a little differently. Sometimes people start talking before it's engaged, and they let go before they finish talking, and those clipped transmissions are a problem for us, because if we don't hear the whole thing, we don't know what instructions to issue. So make sure that you're using good radio manners with your push to talk. And a normal conversational tone, rate, and volume of speech. I'm told I speak fast. I'm probably talking a little fast today. When you're calling inbound, a normal conversational rate of talking and will make it easier for us to understand you on the first time. And if the controllers are talking too fast, just ask us to say again. Usually we'll slow it down. I do that all the time because I'm a fast talker. So if someone says, say again, tower, then the second time I'll say it slowly. The third time I'll get angry. So, you know, I mean, fair's fair, right? The first time, if you're like, hey, I didn't hear you, you're like, oh, you need me to say it again. That's okay. I'll say it again. And then the third time, well, now something, the deal got broken here, right? We didn't follow the rules. Use standard phraseology to remain brief. Sometimes, too, we say, not for us, but as practice, you can speak at a rate that allows information to be written down. When we're issuing IFR clearances, you know, I always spell the waypoints in addition to say them, and I try to say it at a slow enough speed that people can write them down. I'm about like 80% success rate. Sometimes the pilots still miss it. The other day, someone had a complicated route clearance with, I want to say, 7 or 8 waypoints and jet routes on the way. And I gave them the clearance, no professional pilot, no less than 4 times, and they never got the read back right. They had to come back an hour later and get the read back right. We were going to have them file another flight plan because they couldn't get the read back right on the routes. So that's an extreme circumstance, but it happened to me literally like 10 days ago, you know, at the control tower. So I called flight planning and I was like, can we get him another route? They're like, no, that's the preferred route. That's the one. He should have filed it. And I was like, well, he filed something else. I'm like, sorry. But 4 or 5 times couldn't get the read back, and you know, it was quite difficult, quite challenging. We always say no more than 3 pieces of information at a time. So typically, you know, we won't issue more than 3 pieces of information in a single transmission because the retention rate is not very great for that. But a lot of what we're saying you should be expecting. So if you are inbound from the northeast, you're going to get the Maryhill arrival for the right downwind 32. You're going to get the Maryhill arrival for the right downwind 26. You're going to get the Maryhill arrival for the left downwind 08. Like, we know what you're going to get if you're coming from that direction. If you're coming from the south, you know, you might get a right base or a right downwind for 08, left downwind for 26. And that situational awareness will help because you'll be anticipating what it is that we're going to say. If we're going to say something not normal or not obvious, we'll tend to slow it down or say it again or put extra emphasis on it or extra instructions. So that's how we kind of manage that process. Next is aviation occurrence reporting. So those are KDORs, as you guys are probably familiar with. Our business is all about just culture. So we have an atmosphere of trust that we facilitate and foster with all of our employees and with the aviation community at large. When an incident happens, we look to share essential safety information and do an investigation to make sure that we're not repeating these same types of mistakes over and over again. We have a term at work called as low as reasonably practicable. So we're trying to manage risk to as low as reasonably practicable. There's always some risk in the activities that we're engaged with. We want to make that risk as small as possible. And part of that is discussing errors and hazards, incidents and accidents, and system deficiencies without the fear of reprisal. So there's no controller gets in trouble for reporting an incident, and no pilot gets in trouble for reporting an incident. We have a book called, or sorry, we've got some values that come from generating safety reports. So they contribute to hazard and risk management, system behavior and trend identification, collaborative decision making, and collective learning, of course. We are involved in all the aviation occurrence reporting. We're required to report occurrences under Transport Canada CARS 80701 and accidents and incidents to the Transportation Safety Board in a reasonable time frame. We have 72 hours at work to report it if something happens. And we have a book called the Aviation Occurrence Manual, and in it contains everything that's a reportable offense. Some things are not reportable offenses that you think might be. So a wildlife incursion, if it does not affect anybody, is not a reportable event. But if a bird hits an airplane, or if there's a possible bird strike, that has to be reported. If you run over a taxi light, not reportable. If you run over a taxi light and that shuts down the airport for 2 hours, then it is reportable. So there's a little bit of cause and effect that's part of it. But the manual is very stringent. It gets updated every 6 months, and it contains a lot of the more common things that we would see. I think that's kind of it for today. I was going to talk a little bit about staffing. There were some questions that people had sent through, so I'll maybe go back to the podium and check my computer and see what it says. Here is my contact information, my name and my email address. You're welcome to email me with questions or concerns at any time. And then we've also got the national contact information there. That's service@navcanada.ca. They're pretty good at getting back to people, too, if you have a service concern or something that's kind of gone on. Sometimes it'll go to them, and then it'll come to me. And then we'll work together on a response to get back to you. But Nav Canada is customer service oriented for sure, so you'll often get a reply back from an actual human who's done some research and found some actual answers. And if you email me, I am a human, and I will get back to you without using ChatGPT. Yeah, I think that's it. I've got some questions here, and I don't know if people online. I need a second here to log back into my computer. So just bear with me. Okay, so I've got a question here from Jeremy. Jeremy was saying, if I could talk about staffing levels of the tower and the expectation for the coming flying season, and also interested in any thoughts about the balance between providing enough circuits for training and managing capacity for planes taking off have we thought about increasing or decreasing the max number of planes doing circuits at a time? 1 million. We would like unlimited circuits is what we would like to be able to do. So talking about circuits and staffing. So Waterloo Control Tower operates from 7 a.m. to 6 to 11 p.m. every day. In the summertime, we try to run 5 shifts a day. That's 5 controllers per day. That allows us to split ground and tower for the bulk of the day. There is some single stand time, so those are single controller operations almost every day from the tower opening at 7 o'clock until roughly 9 o'clock, sometimes 10 o'clock in the morning is single controller operations. And in the evening from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. are single controller operations. So that's a single controller working both tower and ground, and there's no other controller available for relief. So that means if there's an incident or if there's a problem, there's nobody else in the building yet in order to be able to relieve that controller. So obviously when working under those conditions, we limit traffic a little bit to make sure that we can sustain ourselves for that longer period of time without a bathroom break, without a water break, without any recharging or reloading, depending on what's going on. So in the morning and the evenings, there tends to be a little bit more limits with regards to staffing. Right now, we are currently short-staffed. I think we're supposed to have 12 controllers plus me, and we're currently at 9 controllers plus me. The training period at Waterloo is actually 185 training days, so it takes about a year and a bit to make a new air traffic controller. We have 3 people in training right now. They're looking to qualify, 1 this summer and probably 2 early into 2027. So we'll be short-staffed all summer again. We limit traffic based on staffing. So if there's 4 people per day, you'll see the NOTAM come out that says expect 30-minute delays potentially. We're really good. I don't think anybody gets 30-minute delays, but we put that out there just to let you know that everyone's working as hard as they can, but you're still likely to experience delays. When we have 3 controllers a day, that's where things get interesting. We have fatigue management rules with NAV Canada, which don't allow us to work more than 2 hours in position without a substantive break. So we're only allowed to talk to airplanes for 2 hours before we're required to take a break by Transport Canada and the company's fatigue management rules. And that's because this is cognitively a lot of work. And so after 2 hours, you need a break. Sometimes after 1 hour, you need a nap, depending on who's flying that. But the idea is that after you have worked that hard, you need a little bit of time for your brain to kind of chill off. We don't have a published standard because the answer to how many circuits can we take is it depends. If everybody was flying uniform circuits and everybody was flying their, everyone's radio work was spot on, everyone's radios worked perfectly, everybody's airplane performance was kind of within the same box, we could put a lot more aircraft in the circuit. And I'm sure you've all flown at Buttonville back in the heyday. I mean, I remember being number 7 or 8 in the pattern at Buttonville. The runway was only 3,000 feet long, which is also a major contributing factor because you're only on it for a very short period of time. And there were no touch and goes. So everybody had to land and taxi back around or stop and goes or something like that. It was a different kind of an operation. Here we endeavor to keep 2 in the circuit at all times and then 3 traffic permitting. Much more than 3, it gets unruly. I famously say every time I put 3 in the circuit, I regret it. I did it this morning, or yesterday morning I did it, and all the flying club planes came back at the same time, and so I had 3 in the circuit and 8 aircraft inbound, so I'm working 11 airplanes, and there's just not enough frequency time to get everything happening, right? And then you add in 1 non-compliant pilot, 1 person misses an exit on landing, 1 person's not really good on the radio, and the whole thing starts to become unglued. So typically, 2 in the circuit all day long, the 3rd person, sometimes a 4th or even a 5th will be traffic permitting. And that has a lot to do with the Waterloo Wellington Flying Club and their traffic patterns. So on a busy summer day in the afternoon before sunset, 16 or 17 airplanes will all return at the same time. That's not a great time to be in the circuit for us or for you. So those are some of the considerations that the controllers are aware of, and they're using to manage their workload accordingly. I will say that typically in the mornings, the circuit's available. No guarantees, but like if you were like, man, I really need to get my circuit flight in for currency, I would try to do that before 10 a.m. Very likely you'll get it before 10 a.m. Sometimes not, but very likely. Usually by around 10 or 11 o'clock, the flying club's got all the planes out and all the planes have come back, and it's very difficult to accommodate that type of stuff. We do make an effort anecdotally to have preference for local pilots. So the flying club is in the circuit. We usually give them a couple of slots and try to give a GA aircraft who's based at the field a slot or two. As well, traffic permitting. We're less kind when people come in from faraway places on busy days to use the circuit at Waterloo. Like, maybe come on a less busy day. Especially for circuit traffic, you only need a 1,000-foot ceiling and 3 miles of visibility or 6 miles of visibility. There's lots of days that are good for that, that aren't good for other kinds of exercises, and we'd be able to accommodate that accordingly. So yeah, we'll be short-staffed this summer, like most of the units in the country. I anticipate we won't have any closures, which 2 summers ago we did have a couple of closures where the tower closed for 30 minutes, but we won't have that this year right now. I mean, it could happen, but I think we have enough staff, we'll be okay, and hopefully by summer 2027 we'll be closer to full staff. And 2 to 3 in the circuit is kind of the number. Any other questions about staffing and circuit access? I don't know how you do that, Stephen, but... What about night circuits?
Well, I've struggled to try and get my currency back because every time I come out, I'm in school with aircraft. How do you find a spot?
Yeah, I mean that's a challenge, and we all have to share the runway and share.
Repeat the question, please.
Oh, repeat the question. Sure. So the question is, how do I get night circuits? So Gord wanted to know, he says often he comes out at nights for night currency, and it's difficult for him to get the night circuits because it's full. And there's a couple of challenges with that. One is that, again, we're single controller operations from 9 to 11, and nighttime in the good VFR weather type is that time of day. So it is difficult to take on extra traffic when you're working a single person for the 2 hours without, you know, a substantial break. You know, how to get it, I would suggest to you that, you know, there's an opportunity to get it before daylight savings time. You know, once we start to get into those later summer bashes, it's much more difficult to get the night currency flights in. And also the wind and the weather play a factor. Like last night, I don't think there was anybody, you know, in the circuit, and I think it was VFR enough for circuit activity. And that's always going to be the trick, is that you're probably going to have to do your night circuits or your circuit training on them. I'm not going to say marginal, because I don't think that that's the case, but on the days when the flying club doesn't have the full field dispatched, because when they put 25 airplanes in the sky, it's really difficult for us to take it off. Yeah. They publish their flying status on Twitter, the flying club does, so you can kind of get a sense of what they're doing. So they're pretty transparent about their operation. But for us, unfortunately, we have a resource, which is the controller, and a resource, which is the finite amount of runway. And if you look at the numbers on those nights, like when you can't get that, like, we're busy, like we're moving 60 or 70 airplanes an hour still, so no one's turning you down because they're bored, like because they're lazy or they don't want to. It's really just truly how many airplanes we can safely manage based on the operation that we're running, you know, that day at that time. And the IFR arrivals really put a big damper in the circuit traffic, because they're doing, you know, 140 at the marker, or they start out at, you know, 200 plus on the initial fix, and putting airplanes, it's very difficult to put a Cessna between 2 737s. I mean, you can do it if you're real cute, but it doesn't work usually. Any other questions about circuit and staffing? Okay, I've got a couple of questions here from Richard. The first was on Class E airspace. Given that the airspace around Kitchener's Class E and may include IFR aircraft as well as aircraft with or without transponders or radios, how does ATC handle this type of mixed traffic, and how might this change when the radars are phased out? So obviously, out south, the big non-radar traffic in the area is the Rockton Gliding Club. So they are obviously out of Rockton, just to the southeast of the control zone, and they're not on radar. Most of their glider activity is not on the radar. We see prime targets for that at all. Go ahead. So that's a new development then, because new-ish. Yeah, I'd be curious to talk. I mean, you can reach out to me afterwards. I'd be curious to talk more about that, because that information hasn't quite filtered through. We did get the information about how you guys issue the NOTAM saying glider activity is happening, and it's, you know, from this time, and we put that on our ATIS, you know, to be aware of glider activity in the vicinity. But last year there were, I still remember seeing a number of gliders non-tagged up, you know, in the area. Yeah, so not everybody's an important distinction. The club ones perhaps are all there, and that's great, but that means there's still some non-transponder equipped gliders flying around in the area, and those are challenging. Those are challenging for us for sure. There's been a handful of close calls over the years. So for air traffic control, we can only pass traffic that we know about. So if we see transponder traffic, we can pass that, you know, see and avoid. If we see non-transponder traffic, we can pass that. That's where you'll type an altitude unknown. We have no way of knowing what altitude it's at. If you're squawking 1200 and our radar is getting a return for your aircraft, we will potentially get the position and the altitude, which we can pass on to other aircraft as they exit the control zone. Traffic information is workload permitting and equipment permitting. So as you exit the zone, we'll kind of pass traffic to help you get on course. Sometimes we'll keep you for an extra mile or two if we think something is imminent, but for the most part, it'll be as you exit the zone, we'll pass some traffic and then clear you en route. There are the practice radio frequencies in the area that the flying clubs are using. I think those are published. I'm not super familiar. I think they're in the VTA. I think they're published on the VTA, the practice frequencies. And then 26.7, you know, can be your friend when you're not listening to too many other people talking. Another question about altitude restrictions. On the arrival, you'll receive an altitude restriction not below 2,600 feet. Is it okay to maintain an altitude of 3,000 or more if the weather's hot and bumpy? Or does the altitude restriction mean that you should be at the specified altitude? You're correct. Not below means not below. So you can be at 3,000. You can be higher than that altitude. It's 2,600 is the altitude that we're protecting for. Sometimes you will hear us say descend and fly inbound at 2,600 feet, and that's so that we can put someone above you who will get not below 3,100 feet, and someone above them who will get not below 3,600 feet, and that allows us to stack the airplanes coming into the control zone. But yeah, for the most part, it's okay to say, if we say not below 2,600, it is okay for you to be above that at 3,000 or so, but the controller is likely to notice as you join the pattern and cancel your altitude restriction or ask you to descend depending on how other people are joining the pattern. So for instance, if you're joining the right downwind from the city at 2600 and someone's coming in from Maryhill at 2600 feet, at some point we want one of you lower than the other one. And if you're hanging up high, then that'll, you know, decrease your rate of descent and potentially cause a conflict that, you know, we weren't prepared for, that we weren't really trying to, we weren't really expecting. And that's kind of what we're trying to avoid. Arrival departure points. I'm based at Waterloo and can't remember receiving a departure point clearance over the past few years. That's correct. We don't use them very often. Are these used often enough to warrant keeping them? We have plans. Would it be easier and less confusing for itinerant pilots who might not be familiar with the area just to provide headings? Oh boy. Yeah, we don't use the departure routes very often. Originally, the idea was the departure routes would be at 2,100 feet and the arrival routes would be at 2,600 feet, and so they would be 500 foot separated. However, our radar coverage is very poor below 2,600 feet as you get to the north of the control zone, and so the departure restricting you not above 2,100 just proved to be bad for a lot of reasons. A lot of other airports with routes, I went to Abbotsford last year to look at their arrival routes. They use a combination of altitude and geographic. We'd like to see our routes change to allow for that, but that requires a bunch of work that's just a process that takes a while to do. We'll be keeping them. They are in the CFS. The St. Jacobs departure gets used from time to time. The Automall departure gets used from time to time. The Conestoga College departure, you know, could potentially get used. If you're flying, you're departing, and you would like to use one of those departures, you can always ask on request for ground, like when you're talking to ground control for taxi, you can be like, oh, we'd like to depart to the south via the Conestoga College departure. And if you want to practice that, that's kind of fine with us. Sometimes we'll have to give you a runway heading for a little bit in order to deconflict you with other aircraft inbound. But if you want to fly the departure routes, they are available to you. Would it be easier and less confusing? We sort of want the pilots to read the CFS. So asking us to issue more vectors is just you not reading the CFS, and respectfully, we're trying to give and take here, and so we want people to read the CFS and be familiar with the procedures as opposed to asking us to do more hand-holding. And we'd love to do more hand-holding, but it's just so busy here that it's very difficult to do that safely, and the more time we're spending issuing you specific instructions, the less time we're spending with the other people who are trying to get a note. For arrival waypoints, I've only been asked to use the Maryhill or Sunrise approaches over the past few years and more often been cleared for the approach downwind or base or straight in. Would it be possible to keep only the arrival waypoints that are frequently used in the other cases provide headings? Again, headings are a lot of work. Maryhill, Sunrise do get used the most often. The only other route is the Dumfries arrival, which is used sometimes because it keeps you to the south of the 401 inbound, which is helpful for us for separating traffic outbound. So it sounds like you've gotten, you know, 33, was that 66.6% of the arrival routes. The last one, the Dumfries arrival, doesn't get used too often. And that's mostly because traffic doesn't come in from the south primarily. Maryhill gets used a lot. Sunrise gets used a lot. And the departures less frequently. Is there an appropriate way for an itinerant pod to ask assistance finding an unfamiliar waypoint? If you show up and it's busy and you're not familiar with what's written in the CFS, you will probably be scolded or told to stand by or remain clear of the zone. This is to help us. The waypoints exist to help us manage the flow of the traffic in a consistent way. And if you show up and you're not familiar, it's very difficult for us to issue kind of individual one-off instructions, depending on where you're coming from. If you're truly lost or you're truly unfamiliar, you can check in and say, hey, I'm unfamiliar, request inbound, and you'll likely get a clearance to the control zone with an extra altitude restriction, because if you're unfamiliar, then we don't want you to just come willy-nilly wherever you want. The airport can be difficult to find based on all the city landscape around us here. And if you require a vector, you can request a vector. You can say, hey, can I get a heading inbound? And we can suggest a heading for you to come inbound, workload permitting and equipment permitting. So it does depend a little bit on the traffic situation that we're working at the time. We are here to help, and we are quite very much happy to help. It's just a workload thing. So if you show up on a busy, busy Saturday afternoon and you're not familiar with the arrival procedures, it does create a bunch more workload for us, and it also interrupts service for other people. So that's why we put a lot of emphasis on teaching the or people being familiar with the contents of the CFS. I believe those were all the advanced questions that I received. So I'll take any ad hoc questions that anybody may have after I've spoken today.
Yeah, I have one. I'm equipped with ADSB out, and when I'm inbound before radio contact, does Waterloo Tower see me?
No. The ADSB feed is a bit, it's a controversial, it's not that controversial, but sometimes we get the ADSB feed, sometimes we don't. And you'll show up for us as a 1200 target because your transponder is squawking 1200. And if we mouse over on the display, we'll see some of your ADSB information, like your call sign. But when you call us up, we'll still be assigning a squawk code and asking for your call sign. And that corroborates your call sign in our system, in our flight planning, for our workflows that are going on there. ADS-B is currently not certified for VFR separation. It's 5 miles or greater is what ADS-B can be used for, space-based ADS-B for separation. So it's not useful in a VFR environment where we're typically dealing with less than a mile spacing or a mile spacing between aircraft. So the ADS-B feeds just, because they're not authorized to provide separation, it's a feed that's not particularly useful to us. I'm not sure what NAV does have a website, a page on their ADS-B plans that you can access, and it'll tell you a little bit about where their plans are going. But to the best of my knowledge, it's not a VFR-focused kind of operation. It's mostly to deal with class, you know, B airspace and around the majors like Toronto, Pearson, and what have you. And that was really the FAA strategy originally, too. We just don't have as many major airports that people are flying close to that require that extra level of information. Any other questions?
Yeah, I've got one. So many years ago, I was taught to, when I hear a standby from the tower, not to respond back. But when I'm holding short of the runway, ready to depart, and I don't see the plane that's coming in on final, and I say that I'm ready to depart, tower will tell me, plane on short final, say standby. And so I'm not sure, should I repeat that I'm holding or not repeat back?
So you snuck in another question there, which is repeat that I'm holding. So the reason why we say standby is that if we say hold short, you're required to read it back. So if you say I'm ready to go and we say hold short runway 26, then you have to say hold short runway 26, which most experienced pilots do without hesitation. But because we're a major training airport, a lot of the students don't always get that read back correctly. And so we use standby because it doesn't require a read back and it can't be misinterpreted as another instruction. So that's the reasoning for the standby versus the hold short. As far as acknowledging that transmission, you probably don't need to say, yeah, we'll hold here or anything more than just your call sign. Or you can just, wait in silence. I don't think a controller is going to fish for it for a second time. They'll be looking to make sure you're not rolling up to the line, because that's a very critical part or a high risk area for us. But yeah, if you call ready and we say standby, just acknowledging it with your call sign is probably fine. There's no requirement for you to repeat it back or to add extra stuff like, okay, we'll hold here, or oh, blah, 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 you know, kind of extra. We're not super into that, but definitely acknowledging the transmission with your call sign would be welcome.
Okay.
Oh, we've got someone here. Go ahead, Blake.
Two questions. One is, what would you say is the most common error when it comes to radio work?
Oh, sorry, I'll repeat it. Oh, I could give him the microphone. Hang on.
Yeah, so two questions. So the first one is, what would you say is the most common error from pilots with their radio work? And then the second one is, what is your biggest pet peeve?
My pet peeve is bad radio work. So let's get that out of the way. Most of us don't like saying things twice. And so typically if we get into a situation with a pilot where we have to repeat every instruction or they ask us to repeat the instructions, those really are very cumbersome for us because they involve us revisiting something we've already, you know, kind of done and dealt with, right? So if you call inbound, it's like, okay, Alpha Bravo Charlie Tower cleared right down on runway 26. And you'll be like, Roger, cleared right down on runway 26, and then we forget about you. We don't forget about you, but we move on to the next task. So as longer that transaction drags on, the more difficult it becomes for everybody involved. You know, the rule of three, did you say this or did you mean this? Or like, what happened here? And so we're really trying to keep it, you know, short and concise. So the most common error, I think, is poor readbacks or poor radio work. And sometimes people say the wrong thing, but they know what they mean. So you'll often get the lefts and rights confused. Sometimes we get them confused. Make sure you check those. If you're confused, we gave you a right downwind for 26, right downwind for 26, but you're inbound from the north. People will say, hey, do you really mean left? Like, let's make sure we're clear, because we do make that mistake. But the ones that are funny is that guys inbound from the north, you give him the correct one, and then they read back an incorrect instruction, and then we have to go back and correct it. Or really long radio transmissions. I mean, I always do the shtick, you know, Waterloo Tower, it's Alpha Bravo Charlie. We're 10 to the southwest at 2,400 climbing. We're last off Tilsonburg, inbound for the full stop. We're going to go to the restaurant. I think that's at Apron 2 and Alpha Bravo Charlie. And we're just like, oh boy. You know, so when we're busy, we've got three guys in the pattern. I wish I was joking. You guys know that person. I know you've flown and you've heard them. You've heard them talk. I'm sorry if they're in this room, but that's really problematic for us because oftentimes we're trying to sneak in. Someone's calling inbound. You know, hey, clear to land runway 26. That guy's landing. Number 2, follow traffic, short final. Number 3, follow traffic, left base. Everyone's good there. You call inbound. We're coming to you. But we only want to talk to you for a second because the next instruction is exit left echo, contact ground 121.8. Traffic head vacates the echo, clear to land runway 26. You're number 2 now, traffic's over the number. And then the next guy in the circuit gets a sequence. So all that's tied together for us. That whole sequencing thing is all happening at the same time in our brains. So we're making this much time to talk to you. If you take this much time, then it becomes kind of a problem for us. So yeah, big pet peeve, I think, is people just bad radio work, bad radio etiquette. And I always joke, when I was first training to be a pilot, I was terrified to talk to ATC, and now I'm a controller. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to it, particularly, you know, when people are training and learning on the ground, and the instructors at the flying club are pretty good at taking over from time to time, but some of it's contextual. You know, if you've heard people jamming on the radio for all day and you're trying to sneak in there with a bad radio call, it just makes things really difficult for us. I always laugh, too. Sometimes people call me, and I call them back, and then, you know, it's like, hey, Waterloo Terrace, Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie. And you're like, Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie, Waterloo Terrace. Waterloo Terrace, Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie. I'm like, you called me. Like, I'm ready. Like, let's talk. Let's deal. I'm ready to go. And so sometimes people aren't ready for the instruction, right? Or you issue the instruction, they're like, oh, sorry, can you say that again? And I'm like, whoa, but you called me. You asked for the instruction, right? It's like if you get to the drive-through and someone's like, well, what do you want? You don't know. It's like, well, you need to know. There's people, other people waiting to get their instructions. So, yeah, radio work's always a challenge for us. And that said, though, like, you know, I say radio work's a challenge, but if you're really unclear, if you really forgot, if you really don't know, if you're really, you know, unsure approaching that hold line, yeah, don't guess. Absolutely ask. And I don't think anybody would be mad at you for asking. But I heard an anecdote in the tower this week about someone flying around on a busy day who asked the controller to repeat every instruction. every instruction they had to repeat. So that's excessive. I had a pilot come in from Toronto Island who wanted to go straight in for 26, and I had IFR traffic inbound for 26, and they were in conflict with that aircraft, and they were in conflict with aircraft in the pattern already before they ever entered the control zone. And their radio work was so poor, I could not let them in the control zone. I finally had to say, I'm sorry, you can't, you're going to have to go away and work on your radio work and come back. And they actually ended up, I think they had an instructor on board, and they ended up flying 10 or 15 miles back towards Toronto, then turned back around and came in. They got it right the second time, or they were more manageable the second time coming in. But it was just like, you didn't know what they were going to do because their radio work was so poor. So, you know, practice what you're saying and you know, listen to live ATC if you think you need it, but just know what you're going to say before you hit it. We're actually all very agreeable people. We're just busy. So, you know, we're just trying to work, balance those needs. Another question over here.
Chris, take us through what VFR inbound should say to the tower, what the tower should respond initially with, and what you come back with. That's the pilot. What do you want?
Yeah. So on initial contact, we typically always want, the first contact should always be aircraft type and identification, right? So when you call a tower Waterloo Tower, it's Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie. That's all we want to start. And that gives us a chance to hear your call sign and do a bunch of tasks that you're not seeing. If you left the airport and you were gone for less than an hour, we've already got a flight data entry strip created for you, and we're looking for that, sometimes in a sea of those. We have an instrument in the tower called a TSL, which is, I believe, a transmission source locator is what that stands for, and it gives us the bearing from where your transmission comes from. So when you say, I'm 10 to the north, we'll get a little indicator that says, yeah, it's heading 330 or heading 360. It doesn't give us the distance, but it'll kind of give us an indication where that transmission's coming from. So that initial call, we're trying to figure out who's calling me and where are they, right? And if you're already tagged up, we can look on the radar and see you to the north. And if you're not tagged up, we need to pick you out of the sea of targets that are doing 1200s, that are squawking 1200, and we need to create an FDE, a flight data entry strip, with your information on it. So that first step will be Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie. We'll type that into the computer, and we'll assign a squawk code. So a lot of times, the first call back, you'll be like, Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie Tower Squawk 1234, say your position, altitude, and request. So now I've assigned a code that'll allow me to tag you up on the radar and radar identify you. Once I've identified you, I can bring you into the zone safely. So that's kind of what's going on. So the first call we really want, aircraft type and call sign, and then we'll come back and ask for aircraft, if you haven't given it to us already, it'll be like position, altitude, aircraft type, and assign a squawk code. Sometimes we won't ask for all the rest of that stuff. We'll just assign a squawk code because we're busy. So we'll be like, squawk 1234, I'll get back to you, because we just got to find you on the radar. We can't find you. There's too many other things in the way, or we're too busy and we can't figure out where you are just yet. Once you're tagged up on the radar, now we know exactly where you are. We'll be like, you're identified, say your intentions. Or if we went at the first transmission and said, you know, Alpha Bravo Charlie Tower Squawk 1234, say your position, altitude, and request, you would come back and say, Waterloo Tower, Alpha Bravo Charlie's 10 to the north, 3500 feet inbound, full stop. And you would enter the squawk code, ideally while you're having that conversation or before you hit the transmission to come back. Once you're tagged up, we'll be like, Alpha Bravo Charlie Tower Roger, runway 26 is active, fly the Maryhill arrival cleared right downwind identified. When you hear the words identified, it means that you've been tagged up on the radar and we have a radar target for you. We know where you are. If you don't get tagged up because you're below radar coverage, we'll say negative radar contact, and we may issue an interim restriction, which would be like, enter the report entering the control zone with your altitude, report over Maryhill with your altitude, because we don't know where you are on the radar, and it's hard for us to keep you separate from other traffic if we don't see you on the radar. So the initial call, though, should just be the call sign, and maybe with the ATIS, right? Waterloo Tower Alpha Bravo Charlie with information alpha. And we would come back, assign a code, get you tagged up. That's that first transaction. The first part is, where are you? Where can we want to find you? And what do you want? And then once we figure that out, we'll issue the instruction to the control zone. If you don't have the ATIS, some of us will be like, get the ATIS and call us back. But it's like, not very friendly. There are some places where they're very serious about the ATIS. We're less serious about the ATIS. Transport Canada does have an advisory coming out, which may require us to verify that you have the correct ATIS, which will be funny because people are like, with the information. We're like, oh, really? What information do you have? Do you have the same information that I have? And it's a bit of a game. But there have been a number of incidents where people, where mostly with commercial aircraft, where they're working off an old ATIS potentially, right? So, you know, they get their clearance and an hour later they push to depart and the ATIS has changed and the runway operations changed and their whole system is based off of, they're all set up for a different departure. And so There's been some issues with that, you know, over the years. But call sign and that you have the information and the letter, and then we'll get back to you and assign a code and then bring you in.
Chris? Chris?
Yeah, sorry. There's two at once here. So it's just like being at work right now. Stand by. All of you stand by. Gord was asking if you have a code. Sorry, I missed the last part of that.
Yeah.
Probably not, because we're going to figure that out, and you're just going to give us more numbers that don't mean anything. You're like, oh, it's Golf Alpha Bravo Charlie squawking 1234, and we'll be like, huh? Because that's not information we're attuned to. You want to hear something funny, listen to an air traffic controller talk to an American pilot, right? Waterloo Tower, it's November 1267, Papa Charlie. Aircraft calling Waterloo Tower, say again. Because we're just not used to listening to the numbers, right? It was just like, and if you go to the States, it's the same thing. You fly into the States, you're like, oh, it's Charlie Foxtrot Golf Yankee Golf. I'm like, what? Where's the numbers? You know, like Canadian Charlie. Oh, you're Canadian. This makes sense now. Okay. So the extra numbers, they don't really help us. If we can't find you, we'll assign a new code or we'll get into some extra procedures that we can follow. But typically, if you're already squawking a code, we'll be attuned to kind of where you are. Okay.
The reason I'm asking, I'm a radio examiner and I always discourage that. So I want to clarify.
Yeah. Yeah. ATIS is good in a call sign, not the code. Someone on the computer has a question.
Yeah, Chris, you were mentioning you wanted to hear aircraft type and call sign. So if I'm coming in, do you want me to say Zenith, Golf, Trail Uniform, Delta?
Or I mean, sure.
Like, do you care what aircraft type I'm actually in for performance reasons? Or
usually it's for performance reasons that we're interested in it. So I'm sure your Zenier is very nice. It's a 172 to me, maybe a little faster than a 172. So that's less of an issue. But if you're flying in a jet or you're flying in a fast twin or you're flying in an RV that's, you know, screaming along, that can become kind of, or Cirrus, they can be a lot faster. Sometimes that's a little bit more complicated. But yeah, I mean, the aircraft type can be helpful for us for the performance. That's what we're interested in it for. And we do note the aircraft type in the flight data entry. In your case, your call sign, we have an automated system that actually will assign the correct aircraft type with the call sign. So that's in the system already. So in your case, when you call up, I happen to know this because we've talked before at work, that yours actually pops in, you know, automatically. And the database is pretty robust because it comes from the Transport Canada database. So most of the times when we have mismatches, it's because Transport database is out of date or we haven't gotten like a latest feed from them. But typically the aircraft type issue is mostly about performance. We want to know if you're a high performer or if you're a normal performer.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Blake.
So usually when I'm inbound to any control zone, they always ask me what my last point of departure was. What's the reason for that?
So again, with our flight data entry program, we log where you departed from and that you're arriving here, and that goes to our movements. So if you don't say anything, our strip will actually say you departed from Waterloo, which is obviously impossible for you to like have arrived at Waterloo and departed at Waterloo, like in this particular case. So it's just for data tracking, and that does funnel into some of the aircraft movement statistics that are generated because they're pulled automatically from our system. Sometimes too, it's for flight planning purposes. Maybe you have a flight plan that didn't come through to us, but someone else elsewhere in the system is tracking it, and so they'd be interested to know that, or if they were following up on your overdue flight plan, well, what happened to this person? You know, they'll issue the search and rescue. The first part of the search is literally a phone call. Like, did they land here? Like, what's going on? So, any more questions? Go ahead, Pat.
I have a question about readback. I was out flying last Wednesday. I was a little rusty. I haven't been flown for a few months. Okay, and you noticed. Oh, yeah. And anyway, I was doing circuits on 08, and then we were going to go over to the southwest to do some upper air work. Okay, and so he cleared me for a right turn after the takeoff. I turned right, and he told me to fly a heading of 180 until I crossed over the 401 before turning southwest. And so I just acknowledged Gulf Romeo India and we'll be climbing to 4,500. He wanted a read back. Yeah. Why was that at that time?
Yeah. Because we felt like it. Because we're malicious. It might have been me, actually. I remember talking to you that day, but that sounds like I told somebody that instruction. So it might have been me who told you. Typically, if I issue a restriction, I want the restriction read back. There's no requirement for that, but it make sure that you and I both know that we're on the same page in terms of like what the deal was that we made, because we enter in a contract, right? You're like, I'm like right turnout, fly heading 180. And you only have to say Roger. That is correct. You just have to Roger, acknowledge it with your call sign. That's compliant. That's good radio work. But typically for a restriction, for me, I'll ask the restriction to be read back to make sure that everybody's clear. In the event that you miss that restriction, particularly if it's very important, like there's another airplane coming in that direction that you may hit that I don't want you to hit, typically then that's also for the tape. So if there was an incident afterwards and I instructed you to fly a heading 180 and you didn't read it back, then there's some confusion when we do the incident report in terms of listening to the audio and saying, did the pilot get that transmission? Did they hear something else by accident? You know, people get their numbers confused all the time. And so the best way for us to ensure that the instruction was correct is to get it be read back. Some restrictions, any weird restrictions, like new ones, I'll typically ask people to do. But like the Maryhill arrival is not below 2600 all the time. So sometimes we don't really, the arrival contains that restriction. So we rely on that procedure. But assigning a heading, there's always a possibility that you may misinterpret the heading. And we see that a lot, like, you know, make a left 270 to base. You know, what's like, that's a good one. Do you want to fly 270 degrees? Do you want to make a 270 degree turn? Well, where's the clearance afterwards? You know, and or a right 360, that's slang. Make a right 360. Is that turn right, fly heading 360? Or is it make a right hand orbit? These are very different things. So sometimes the implications can be pretty big. So just as a standard practice for some of us, it's not required, will require restrictions to be read back. And like depends on, probably if there's someone coming the other way and I really need you to do it, I'll make sure that the restriction gets read back because I don't have time to watch it. I'm putting that restriction in place so I don't have to watch it, right?
I have a brush jet, my radio work. I know that. My wife and I don't talk VFR phraseology.
Well, my wife and I do, so it's normal, you know. It's really like, honey, can you pass the milk? Anyways. Any other questions online? Yeah.
Be prepared for changes. I was coming into the northwest. Mm-hmm. I was cleared to right hand downwind for runway 26. About to join right hand downwind, and the controller said, join left hand downwind for runway 26. So overfly the field.
Yeah.
So, okay. So just be ready for.
Yeah, absolutely. So that story is very salient. Like a lot of times we'll bring people in, and then the situation changes last minute, or it changes, and we were a little bit behind and we're playing catch up. So crossing overhead the field to the opposite downwind is something that will happen. Typically before you're established in the downwind, you would expect that. The other one that gets people a lot of the times, myself included, is a runway heading on departure. So sometimes when we issue the touch and go clearance, there's no conflict with other traffic coming in. And then in the time that it's, you know, if we issued you a touch and go clearance a mile final, you know, you're like 1 minute to the threshold, 1 minute for the rollout, you know, 3 minutes, you know, to get airborne at the other end, another minute off the end of the runway, we're talking 4 minutes potentially for that whole action to take place. Well, someone's coming in a really fast airplane, you know, from the northwest, they're going to join a left downwind, they're going to be in conflict with you. And so on the climb out, you'll hear us say climb runway heading, because we're trying to protect for that fast airplane coming in from the left. A lot of our job is breaking ties. I make a lot of ties, but we eventually have to break them. So that's kind of the challenge with it, with that crosswind turn. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Changes can happen at any time. We always want you know, aware of them. Okay, well, no more questions online?
Hey, okay, got one. So.
Oh, got one? Okay.
Hey, historically at Waterloo, we turn our crosswind at about 500 feet. Now, in the U.S. at uncontrolled airports, they recommend turning the crosswind at about 700 feet. And I think there's been a change in Canada suggesting at uncontrolled airports we turn the crosswind at about 700. What does Nav Canada say?
So Nav Canada doesn't determine that. Transport Canada, I believe, still says 500 feet. I don't know if they've changed it to 700. What we'll tell you at the control tower is we probably don't want you turning before you got to the end of the runway. So some high performers are on windy days will hit 500 feet midway down the runway and they'll turn crosswind early and potentially conflict with somebody joining because it's not an anticipated confliction point if you turn that crosswind very early. But by the book, it's 500 feet. And we see often a 152 ahead of a 172, and the 172 is 500 feet and they want to turn and the 152 is still climbing, trying to get out. So we often have to prompt the 152s to make the turns early in order to keep the circuit of a manageable size. because a manageable size circuit means more circuits for everyone. But that's definitely the challenge. But yeah, I would say 500 feet. I don't think that 700 foot thing has caught on here. I believe Transport issued their uncontrolled procedures. They updated them. I thought it was last year. I'm not. Yeah. And did they change? Do you remember? Did they change?
700? I don't think so.
Yeah.
It just makes it more clear for different aircraft types, like helicopters versus jets.
Yeah. So there was some updates there, but I haven't heard of the 700. And Blake saying he didn't see the 700 in that either. But that would be the document to go from. We don't set any of those procedures. Those are CARS. So that's. It's all CARS procedures. Noise abatement isn't us. We just do what the law tells us to do. We do what the airport tells us to do. We don't set any of those. We don't set any of those rules. They're not up to us. We break them, you know, like turn crosswind now. That we'll do that. Great. Well, thanks a lot, everybody, for having me. If you have any questions, you can funnel them through Gord or you can email me directly. It's been a pleasure, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris. That was great. Really enjoyed it. And I'm sure that our members online will...